This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Sandra Stanton joins me live in studio. She is the Shannon Senior Historian at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, online at monticello.org. Sandra, it's great to have you here. Thanks for coming in.
Happy to be here.
I have to tell you, I have followed your work for so long, and I am in awe of the work that you have done as a historian at Monticello in telling so many stories that had never been told before. And I think it's a great model for any aspiring historian or writer to study your career and your work that you have done at Monticello. It's fascinating, but it's also so unbelievably important, and it truly is an honor to have you here.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I think so long is the operative word there. I've been at Monticello over 30 years and seen it change a great deal in that time.
What is it you think that most people don't know about Monticello?
Well, I think because of what they see, they don't realize that it was a plantation of 5,000 acres with up to 200 people living on it in Jefferson's time, because all the wheat fields have grown up into forest. The tobacco barns have fallen down. That vision of the plantation is invisible right now. So we've been striving to, over the last 10 or 15 years, to find ways to let the visitor know that Jefferson wasn't up on the mountain all by himself creating that, and that there were all kinds of people, his own family members, free workers and their families, and the majority population, which were the enslaved men, women, and children.
Yeah, we're talking with Sandra Stanton of Monticello. And when we talk about the enslaved population at Monticello on 5,000 acres, I mean, how many people are we talking about at any one time?
Well, it ranged from about 90 to 145 of the African Americans there at any one time. 145, I think, was the high point in about 1814.
Yeah. But over the course of the his lifetime, we're talking about hundreds of people, right, in extended families. And
not just at Monticello, but in all Jefferson's landholdings over the course of his lifetime, he considered himself the owner of more than 600 people. We have a database of all the names of the 600 people that lived in slavery on his properties.
Yeah. Tell us about his relationship to slavery. And I know I've researched and written about this myself, and you know, but what's your take on this and your perspective about Thomas Jefferson's slavery? Hundreds of people that he owned throughout his life, and he freed what, seven, I think?
You know, not many more than that.
Yeah. Right. When at a time when, you know, there's some people who say, well, that's just, you know, they didn't free slaves, but actually people were freeing their slaves left and right at this time, you know, after he retired from the presidency. George Washington freed his slaves. What are your thoughts on this issue?
Well, my thoughts are always evolving on this issue because it's so complex. Whole books have been written about Jefferson in relationship to slavery. And I think that we have to see how Jefferson thought about things. He was the epitome of the American Enlightenment, with great optimism about the perfection of society. And he really thought that over time, everybody would come to understand that slavery was a terrible evil and it would vanish away. But I think he got discouraged later in life. But while slavery was the law of the land, Jefferson was not about to rock the boat, so to speak. So he was not about to free his own slaves en masse. And that's why there were just some individual manumissions in his lifetime and in his will. Yeah. But he did hope, he was very hopeful that there would be a general emancipation.
We are honored to be talking with historian Sandra Stanton of Monticello. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. You've got a question or a comment for Sandra. Tell us about the Getting Word Project. And we want to talk about some of the specific stories that have come out of this research. But generally speaking, when did this start? What was the vision? And how did this get off the ground? Because it's a huge, huge project.
Well, it has lasted about 16 years. It started because of 1993, Jefferson's 250th birthday, when we were trying to expand programming about slavery and the African-American experience at Monticello. And we had this incredible archive that Thomas Jefferson left, which I think you might have heard about last week, over 60,000 documents. And from the perspective of the enslaved people, just a few recollections and a dozen letters. So we thought that if we went out and sought the descendants of the enslaved families of Monticello, we might be able to hear the voices of their ancestors. And I should mention, since Rob Vaughn is coming later, that the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities was the early supporter of this project. And so off it went. And
where did you start?
Started by hiring a project historian, and that was my colleague Diane Swan Wright. And we've worked on this project since 1993. And our first interviewing trip was to Chillicothe, Ohio, where we knew there were dozens and dozens of descendants of the Hemings family living in that area.
Now, refresh our memories here. Who went to Chillicothe, and when, why, and what did you find when you went there?
Well, these were some of the grandchildren of Elizabeth Hemings of Monticello, the matriarch of the Hemings family, Madison and Eston Hemings, the sons of Sally Hemings and, as most people believe, Thomas Jefferson, went to this part of southern Ohio, as did members of the Fawcett family, who were Sally Hemings' nephews. And there they all were. We hosted a reception for about 40 people, and some of the people there had known each other all their lives and not known that they were related and connected to Monticello, because the story of that connection was kept so closely within their families.
Why do you think that was?
Well, a lot of it is the climate of denial and mockery of their story that they were descended from Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And also there was the whole issue of slavery. Slavery was such a negative that people would ask their elders about the earlier times, and they say, we just don't talk about that. Let's look forward, not back. And so there was a tremendous silence that we kept encountering.
Wow. Now, how did you get through that?
Well, you can't do us. I mean, everybody was very willing to talk, but so many of the stories, I naively expected that we'd go out there and get stories of life at Monticello. But what's survived really are the core truths. And say, for the descendants of Sally Hemings and Jefferson, that truth is the family tree. We're descended from those two people. And that's almost all that's survived in that family. And for another branch of the Hemings family, it's very much about our ancestors helped people get out of slavery through the Underground Railroad, forging free passes, and things like that. That's in the Fawcett side of the family. So that was the most important story to pass on for them.
Yeah. We're talking with historian Sender Stanton of Monticello. You can learn about the Getting Word Project online at monticello.org/gettingword. These people who were enslaved at Monticello, the story often told is, well, when Jefferson died, he was in terrific debt, so they had an estate sale. The estate sale included, you know, furniture and people. And these people were literally sold to help pay off the debts that he had incurred when he was still living that had been passed on to his family. What did you learn about that process? Did they just disperse, or did many of them stay in the community? What happened?
Well, over these 16 years, we learned bit by bit that many of them did stay in this area. And when you look at the fragmentary records that do survive about this sale, which was over 100 slaves in 1827, you see that young children, 9 and 10, were sold away from their family, sold as individuals. But then we have something like the story of Peter Fawcett, who was 11 when he was sold at that sale. And over the course of this project, we found a photograph of Peter Fawcett. We found his recollections where he talks about the sale being sold away from his family, how he had to remain in slavery another 25 years and tried to run away twice. And also the story of his father, his effort, Joe Fawcett, the head blacksmith at Monticello, his effort to reunite his shattered family after this sale. And only in the last year did we finally realize, now that all kinds of things are online, it's very exciting, that that Joseph and Edith Fawcett managed to reunite virtually all their children with them in freedom in Cincinnati by the end of their lives.
Wow. What a story.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And there are all kinds of stories like this within this community.
Yeah. It truly was a community. I mean, and that's one thing, as you say, that's one thing that you really don't see when you visit Monticello today. You see the big, beautiful house, and you think of him there with his family, but you don't see Mulberry Row. You don't see all the people who worked literally from sunup to sundown and were constantly coming and going and working nonstop 7 days a week.
Right. And one of the inspirations for me for this project was talking to an African-American woman on Mulberry Row in the early 1990s. And I explained how there had been all kinds of dwellings and workshops along the row in Jefferson's time. But she looked down the row and there was nothing but grass and trees. And then she looked up at the beautifully cared for house, the mansion, and she said, "It's as if we've been erased." And so that's what this project is trying to do, to end that erasure of that community.
Senator, what's the sentiment now among the staff at Monticello and the leadership there when it comes to Mulberry Row? When I know that for a long time there's been this conversation, should we rebuild the Mulberry Row buildings and have people working there, or just, you know, some type of display so that there is a presence on the landscape aside from, you know, the decayed foundations sticking out of the grass. What's the sentiment up on the mountain now, you think?
Right now, the sentiment is very excited about doing something about that emptiness on Mulberry Row, and the project is really taking off to probably reconstruct a couple of buildings, if not all of them, in the near future. And
that's
all kinds
exciting.
Of people are working on this, and everyone there is very much in support of this.
Yeah, that's very exciting, because it really is going to make it possible then to tell the stories and the story of this as a real community of people who lived up there, and tell the story that's really not being told sufficiently, I think, of this enslaved community,
right,
who were so much a part of his life, his day-to-day life, you know?
Yes, and even though we have a wonderful outdoor tour that focuses on the lives of the enslaved people there, it only runs in the season, you know, not through the winter. So if there are structures there with interpretive something or others to help the visitor, I think it'll be a wonderful thing.
Yeah. We're talking with Senator Stanton. She is the Shannon Senior Historian at Monticello, and you can learn a whole lot online at monticello.org/gettingword. Senator, another one of those folks at Monticello who was sold is Henry Martin, who I have come across, of course, in my history research of UVA again and again and again, a central figure in the 19th century and early 20th century life at the University of Virginia, and arguably in Charlottesville, because he rang the bell in the rotunda and then in the chapel after that was built in 1885, every hour on the hour from 4 a.m. to 10 p.m. for over 50 years. And when he died in 1916, he was the last living connection to Thomas Jefferson, because he had been born, if I'm not mistaken, was born at Monticello the day Jefferson died.
That's what he told people, yes. We can't find it in the records, but it's very, very possible, certainly. And we haven't exactly figured out who his parents were, but the story certainly makes sense, everything that he says. And we have interviewed one of his descendants.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
And he said, "I am as true to that bell as to my God," when he was talking about the bell and the rotunda.
So what are you working on now? What's front burner for you now?
Well, I'm about to go to Scotland and talk about this project, which is exciting to people in Glasgow. And so thinking about how to explain some of this history to people in the UK who don't have a complete grasp of, you know, the bizarre construction of race, for instance, in this country, and what that does to people. So I've been thinking about how to talk about some of the people we've talked to through the Hemings family who have lived on the edge of the color line, who are light enough to pass for white. Some do, some don't. And the terrible choices they have to make in the course of their lives. So that's what I'm thinking about right at the moment.
Did Great Britain have the history of slavery as we've seen in America? Did they have any of that?
Yes, up until the end of the 18th century. And then, of course, they abolished slavery in their colonies in, suddenly I've forgotten the date, 1830-something.
Yeah.
But they had very few people of African descent in the country, and so they didn't have these strange race laws and treatment of people the way we did.
While I'm thinking about it, I wanted to ask you about the young woman that Jefferson made sure got sent north, the daughter of Sally Hemings, and many historians believe Jefferson's own daughter by Sally Hemings, was sent to Philadelphia by stage. Is that the right story? Did you ever, was there any luck tracking down this woman?
No, she has not been found, nor her descendants, although there are many Harriet wannabes out there who, especially after the DNA results came out in 1998, who came forward and said they thought they might be descended from Harriet Hemings. But nobody has been found. And that was Jefferson's overseer, Edmund Bacon, who said he gave her money, according to Jefferson's instructions, to put her on the stage to Philadelphia. However, we think she went to the Washington area instead.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And then I guess the thinking is that she just passed into white society as a white woman.
Yes, and perhaps her husband and children never knew.
Wow, what a story. So before I let you go, I have to ask you, what's the dream project? I mean, what's the project on the back burner that you haven't perhaps started yet or that you really want to do as part of your research?
Well, I need to get back to the book I was working on before all this took off, which was on the Monticello plantation, the enlightened plantation, Jefferson, and everything he tried to do to make the plantation run efficiently and mathematically, and the effect it had on the land and the people. But meanwhile, I've got to finish this book on the Getting Word Project because there's so many incredible stories that need to come out, just wonderful, wonderful things.
Yeah.
So That's what I've got to do first.
It's been great to have you here. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
by.
You. I've enjoyed it.
Check it out online. It's monticello.org/gettingword. Cinder Stanton, she's the Shannon Senior Historian at Monticello. Thank you for being here.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.